Deuxième table ronde, Daniel Bellan va être mon inside man dans cette table. Je vais me contenter de le présenter et puis de lui passer la parole pour présenter ses collègues. Donc Daniel est professeur à l'Université de Saskatchewan, où il est titulaire d'une chaire de recherche canadienne en politique publique à la Johnson Choyama School of Public Policy. Et il a publié beaucoup sur les questions de politique sociale, changement politique, le rôle des idées en politique. Donc, Daniel, tu peux présenter les trois autres participants et je te laisse la parole.
Merci, Johan. Rebonjour. So I will switch to English, of course, for this second roundtable. So, and I want to introduce you in English, that you know what I'm saying about you. You can correct me if I make any mistake. So Klaus Petersson is a historian and a full professor at the University of Southern Denmark. He has written extensively about social policy issues in Scandinavia and beyond. And recently he co-edited a volume on social policy expertise. Maybe you can show the volume here. Very good.
In experts we trust.
That's certainly a question we can talk about today. This issue of trust is very important when we discuss the role of a social scientist in public policy. Diane Stone, to my left, it's not a political statement, but maybe. Diane Stone is professor of governance in the Murdoch School of Public Policy and International Affairs in Perth, Australia. And she's also a professor of politics and international studies at the University of Warwick in the UK. So she studies international global governance, the internationalization and the production of expertise around the world. And she's also a global scholar because she holds positions in two different continents. She has written, published extensively about think tanks, international organizations, and the production of expertise at the global level. And she has also worked on even the production of expertise in Australia, recently published an article in the Australian Journal of Political Science on a policy entrepreneur, Australian policy entrepreneur. So she brings a global perspective on the issue of expertise. And finally, Kent Weaver. Kent Weaver is a distinguished professor of public policy at Georgetown University. And Kent joined the Georgetown Public Policy Institute in 2002 after 19 years at the Brookings Institution, which is one of the oldest and most prestigious think tanks in the United States. During the previous roundtable, we mentioned the role of think tanks in relationship to political parties in France, but of course, in the United States, most think tanks have nothing to do with parties, and the Brookings, I can't refer to it as a university without students, and it will be interesting to talk about this issue of the role of think tanks in the United States, and Kent has published extensively about think tanks, but also about social policy reform, including welfare reform and pension reform. So we'll start with you, Kent, maybe because we want to provide really international perspectives on expertise and the role of social scientists in policymaking, but also in social criticism and in politics. And think tanks are especially influential in the United States. You have literally hundreds and hundreds, if not a few thousand think tanks. Thousands of think tanks in the United States. Some of them are really big and well-known, like the Brookings Institution or the Cato Institute or the Heritage Foundation, and others are really small. They operate only at the state level and so forth. So in your opinion, what's the relationship between social scientists and think tanks? Is the fact that think tanks are so well-regarded in the United States and ever-present, is it an avenue for social scientists to really reach out to policymakers and to have an impact on public debates? Or are social scientists who work for think tanks are sometimes poorly regarded by their colleagues. We talk in the first round table about sometimes in France where scholars who provide policy advice, they are regarded as not totally scientific or not that serious or not interested in you know, social science in the strong sense of the term. What's the role of think tanks in the United States in mediating the relationship between social scientists and policy expertise?
Okay, well, it's very complicated, in part because the think tank sphere in the U.S. is such a large one and such a diverse one that there are many different types of organizations that go under the rubric of think tanks, from what I would call universities without students, which do have academic researchers, mostly with social science PhDs on their staffs, to very large contract research organizations like the RAND Corporation and the Urban Institute, which again have lots of social science PhDs, many of whom come to these institutions because they have an interest in translating the findings of social science research to a broader audience, and in particular to an audience of policymakers. And then within this broad category of think tanks, you do have organizations that are really very close to advocacy bodies that do have a clearly established point of view, or less likely to have PhDs. And for both policymakers and for the public, this poses a problem because there aren't clear certification boundaries, and there aren't clear boundaries on, you know, what is a think tank and what is not. So, you know, an organization like the Heritage Foundation and Brookings, which I would argue are quite different organizations, aren't always. It's difficult for the public to distinguish between them. But I think that they play a significant role, but that role has changed over the last few decades as the political environment has changed and the environment for funding has changed, and the whole essentially ecology of how social science research is translated into policy in the United States has changed. Certainly in the political realm, you have an increased polarization of politics that now many politicians, particularly, I would say, within the Republican Party, are no longer interested in hearing what the best neutral experts have to say. They say, well, you know, I have a particular set of values, and I want to hear from experts who share basically my value orientation, who start with my assumptions and maybe my policy preferences or prejudices, proceed from there, which is quite different from the way that the more traditional, more academically oriented think tanks, who are staffed by people, you know, if you look at the career flows, staffed mostly by people historically who came from universities, as I did, and left to go to universities, as I did. I mean, it's not an untypical career path, but I think becoming less typical even within those research institutions. Another thing that's changed very importantly is the funding environment. There now is sort of less funding available to do sort of pure social science research with policy applications than there was even 15 years ago. That the big funders among foundations now want you to do things that are more clearly have immediate policy applications, to have, let's say, stakeholder seminars where you bring together policymakers of different points of view, or at the state level and at the national level. So it's become more difficult to do sort of pure but policy relevant research because the funding isn't available, and more ideologically oriented foundations are increasingly big players in funding more the advocacy tank kind of environments. I do want to say a couple of words before I close these introductory remarks about think tanks are just one way to produce one sort of institution to get social science expertise into the policymaking process. I think an important development over the last 20 years in the United States, and it would be interesting to make comparisons to ENA in France, where there's been a tremendous growth of public policy graduate schools in the United States. And I think that that's had a really quite important impact, because it used to be within economics departments and political science departments, doing policy-relevant research was seen as a career killer, basically. It was not something that would benefit your career. But now a whole environment has grown up of policy-relevant journals, and particularly within economics, where there are applied micro journals that now have that are essentially driven by the data that people can come up with to look at real social world phenomenon. It helps if you can apply fancy econometrics to them. My son is getting his PhD in economics, so I'm very much attuned to this. But they are policy relevant. And so I think that that development is one thing. And within the discipline of economics, I would say the growth of behavioral economics has also led to an interest in let's not just look at how theory says the world works, let's look at how people actually do behave. I think that that's had a downside, that there's been more attention to individual motivations and cognitive psychology orientation rather than to structural constraints on policy and on individual and collective behavior. So that's had a downside. But the whole environment, basically, I would say, is changing in some ways that make it easier to make social science research more directly applicable, and providing the career rewards to social scientists to do that. And in some ways made it more difficult.
So just to, we talk a lot during, there was discussion in the first roundtable here in France about the idea that a lot of politicians and high-ranked civil servants, at least, that they really look down on social scientists who are really perceived as people who have nothing really to contribute to public policy. In your experience interacting with policymakers, what's your how do you think you're being perceived by people in government? And how do you think, so expertise that comes from academia or from these policy schools you mentioned, is it highly regarded, or is there some skepticism and you have to make an effort really to show that you know what you're talking about and that you have pragmatic solutions to bring to the table?
Well, I think that there's always some skepticism, but the word that was used quite strongly in the first panel, contempt, I would say, is much weaker in certainly in the U.S. and environment, and I've spent the last 3 months in Sweden, and even weaker there. That there is a perception that we've got problems to deal with. We need to look broadly at people who can provide us with ideas. Certainly the notion that all of the good ideas come from within the bureaucracy is not something that policymakers in the U.S. have. And it's a decentralized political system, again, increasingly a polarized system, which makes it difficult to provide advice across sort of the party and ideological lines. Not impossible, but harder to do that. But because political careers are based in part on advancing policy ideas, and if you want to run for the Senate from your state, having previously been a member of the House of Representatives, say I introduced some bills at least to address this issue, they're always looking for those policy ideas that will allow them to be perceived as having a record as a responsible legislator. So, career paths for politicians matter as well as career paths for academics.
Thank you very much. I want to turn to Diane Stone because you have done, first of all, you have worked and taught in several countries, which is important too, considering what you're studying, the internationalization of expertise, the role of international organizations, and you're originally, I think, from Australia, but you have taught in the UK, in Hungary. Mm-hmm. Maybe I could start before talking more about the internationalization per se. What's your take on these differences in national context, and they affect the relationship between social scientists and policy making and public debates in general. Because we had the first roundtable focusing on France. Now we heard about the United States, but the United States is a very big country, but it has also very distinct institutions and political culture. So, what's your take on the relationship between social scientists and policy debates? Do you think that there is a lot of variation from country to country? And do you also think that there is really an internationalization of expertise taking place, and that there are vehicles now available for social scientists to make a difference beyond the national level, mm-hmm. within the European Union, for example, and also international organizations? You have done work on the World Bank, for example. Mm-hmm. So I'm asking you several questions in one, so yes. You can say what you want, basically. Okay.
Thank you. I'll take them as two separate questions, the comparative question first, and then I'll get on to internationalization of expertise. And I think it's a very important consideration to keep in mind that there is considerable variation, and that national context does make a considerable difference because of different historical and institutional trajectories. So if I take the Australian system, which has a small population, and if I think of social sciences, it's a small pond. Okay, you tend to know other social scientists quite well, even from other disciplines. So political scientists will mix with economists, who will also mix with sociologists. So there is much more interaction across the disciplines. But one thing that is to be said about the Australian system is that until recently, it was dominated by state funding. The federal government was the prime source of funding for social science research, for scholarships for students, for the general infrastructure and upkeep of universities. So it was the dominant player within the Australian system. This is a bit different to the UK system, which had a much more diversified ecology, where the British state was also very, very important in subsidising student education and research through the National Research Councils. But you also had philanthropic associations as well that were providing funding. So the Wellcome Trust, I think until about a decade or so ago, was the world's largest foundation and has since been overtaken by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and I'll come back to them in a moment. So what I'm saying is that the United Kingdom was a much bigger ocean of social scientists and other kinds of scientists as well. It also interacted much more extensively between with Europe and European social scientists. And there were more sources of funding. But to go to one of the points that was made at the end of the last session about the taxpayer, should there not be some return to the taxpayer in demonstrating the utility and the social relevance of social science? That is actually quite palpable in both Australia and the United Kingdom, in the sense that governments in both countries have instituted national review systems. In the United Kingdom, it's called the Research Evaluation Framework. In Australia, it's the quality assessment exercise. And that is to demonstrate, on the one hand, that scientific research as well as social scientific research is to a rigorous standard, meets international standards, and is of sound quality on the one hand. But on the other hand, it is also about demonstrating that social scientists do have relevance to government, to industry, to community, to civil society, broadly defined. So because in both systems, money follows the kind of score that you're awarded. So in the UK, if you're awarded a 5, you get more money to your institution and to your department than if you're awarded a 3. What this has done is to produce a range of incentives for social scientists to demonstrate that they are useful. And there are multiple ways of demonstrating that you are useful. In the UK, it has a much more qualitative edge in the sense that departments and individuals are able to produce case studies that can demonstrate their influence with government or influence with an international organisation or with civil society over a 5 to 10 year period. So you can develop that kind of historical analysis in the UK. By contrast, in the Australian system, it's much more quantitative and based on a metric system. So you have to demonstrate how many citations you get, how many columns of media print talking about your own research, how many grants you get. So it's much more based on a tick box approach in the sense of demonstrating that you're getting attention, and attention from government or industry or a range of other users. So it's much more instrumental in Australia than I think it is in the case of the United Kingdom. So there are differences there, and part of it is size, I think. What is happening also is that there are potentially some negative outcomes of chasing funding in both systems because you get more status, you get more institutional recognition, your own individual career prospects are enhanced if you get funding from the National Research Councils or from a philanthropy or whatever, you're chasing money. And I think you might have seen some of the major scandals that have come out. British American Tobacco funded a chair in corporate social responsibility at Nottingham University. All the medical scientists were so outraged about this, as was the Wellcome Trust, it withdrew all its funding to the medical sciences. So they might have got one chair, but they lost a huge amount of money. And it's taken a long time for Nottingham University to re-establish its reputation in that area. A bigger example of a disastrous funding relationship came with the Gaddafi Foundation and its funding support to the London School of Economics. Again, the reputational damage there was huge for that institution, and it's still chugging along. So that's probably where I'll stop on the comparative side of your question. In terms of the internationalization or the transnationalization of expertise, this has been occurring for quite some time. It's been occurring alongside the growth of international organisations. Now, putting the European Commission aside, most international organisations have very small secretariats. So the World Bank, for example, is only about 11,000 employees. The WTO, the World Trade Organization, is only about 800 full-time staff members. So these kinds of organisations, they're just two examples, need to contract in outside expertise in support of their kinds of activities. The World Bank is very systematic about it. It has a number of different mechanisms and practices to engage with the research community. One organisation that both Kent and myself have been involved with is the Global Development Network, which was sponsored by the World Bank, but also by the United Nations Development Programme, and has a range of bilateral donor supporters, whether it's from the Japanese or the Swedish or various other organisations. So this is a permanent body that's been established, which was set up as a network of think tanks and research institutes and individuals from developing countries to help boost research capacity within developing countries, but also to help those researchers based in developing countries converse and interact with World Bank officials and other development officials roughly on the same level, okay, to bring them up to the same level of research in terms of the methodologies that have been used. But also the World Bank has its own internal research unit called the Development Economics Research Group, which has its own permanent staff, but they bring in visiting scholars as well. Those scholars are more often than not economists, but you do occasionally see anthropologists and sociologists as well. The World Bank is interesting in the sense that many of its staff have PhDs, so they're quite good at absorbing expertise. That also applies to a number of other international organisations that might have a more specific policy focus or mandate in a field of environment or migration or some other field. So you have more specialised staff. So going back to the World Bank, which is an example I'll stick with for the moment, you see many of their staff also acting as adjunct professors at Georgetown University, but also Harvard University, other kinds of universities. So you get, it's not a simple situation in the case of this organisation of inside-outside, that you have bureaucrats inside the international organisation and researchers outside. There's much more of an interactive process that the bank is keen to support, and also many academics and researchers like to take advantage of as well. So the bank, amongst international organisations, I would say is quite a porous organisation. It's open to expertise. That doesn't necessarily apply to all international organisations. And also you see different kinds of practices occurring. So for example, at a regional level, I'll take an example that I know well, and this is in relation to the Association of Southeast Asian Nations. Again, this is a regional association which is not like the European Union. It's very informal, it's very loose, it's based on consensus and discussion. The secretariat is extremely weak. So as a consequence, there is a lot of interaction between elite scholars and researchers with political leaders and bureaucrats. Now, in part, this has historically been to do with the size of government and ministries in Southeast Asian nations and the need to rely on outside expertise, but also because the building of region, this notion of ASEAN, has occurred at a later period of time in relation to the European Union. Intellectual scholars and researchers have played an extremely influential role in the Southeast Asian context in helping build regional association. So there is a clear trajectory that has been established. It's something of a consensus in the scholarly literature that research institutes and think tanks, and elite think tanks connected to government, not independent, have been crucial in the establishment of the Council for Security Cooperation in the Asia Pacific, which is now an intergovernmental body. So that's a different kind of process that's occurring at that regional level. And again, if you do comparative regional approaches, I think you'd see differences again with the Africa Union and various other bodies as well. And then finally, and I'll end on this point, there is also a proliferation of global and regional public-private partnerships or global policy programs or stakeholder initiatives. They go by various kinds of different names. It's actually extremely difficult to grow or create a new international organization. It takes a long time. You need to have parliaments of ratifying nations put through the ratification process through their national legislatures. It's difficult. It's actually much quicker to outsource some functions from international organizations to these multi-stakeholder initiatives. So one example is Gavi. Gavi is one of the older established bodies. It's the Global Alliance on Vaccines and Immunization. It's a public-private partnership between, on the one hand, the Gates Foundation, a number of international organizations, and national governments aimed at delivering vaccinations programs to poor communities around the world. It brings in a lot of medical and pharmacological expertise into that particular organization and is just one example of several hundred of these kinds of organizations or entities that have emerged worldwide.
Yeah, I just wanted to jump in and ask, have a question about what Kent and Diane just said. The trends that you describe, and particularly the incentives for social science to demonstrate their usefulness and their relevance, is it to the detriment of the capacity of social critique in social sciences? And at the same time, it seems that we've witnessed, in the case of the US, a growing politicization, as you've said, of think tanks and expertise. So would you say that, how would you say it is affecting the status of social scientists within policy and political debates in this respect?
Yes and no. Okay. Yes, there is a detriment in the sense of a need to demonstrate your social or economic relevance, which can force you to focus on the mainstream or orthodox positions. But at the same time, certainly in Australia, in the UK and Europe, I would say that the professional norms and what is considered to be high academic standards and appropriate research approaches is still very, very strongly entrenched and hasn't been undermined. So I think there is a strong sense of community tolerance for difference, deviance and critique that still allows for those alternative perspectives and positions to come through. The channels through which they're expressed might become more constricted, potentially, but then on the other hand, you have to look at social media and the way in which that has also allowed for new forms of dissemination and diffusion of social critique. It's not this slow process of publication anymore, or radio or TV commentary, which was limited to a relative few. So yes and no. Yeah.
So I agree very much with what Diane said, that I think that there, within, let's say, policy schools and also think tanks, there. The sort of mainstream think tanks, there is a constriction to, what are mainstream debates. So you're more likely to find, a serious outsider critique of, American social structure or policies within disciplinary departments rather than within policy schools, which just because of their recruitment practices, I think, tend to have a more practical orientation, that students are sort of interested in operating within the mainstream status quo institutions. But I agree with Diane that there's been this proliferation of channels and proliferation of institutional venues that operates in the other direction.
Can I just add a small thing?
Yeah.
I mean, because if we discuss the influence of social sciences, I mean, can you hear me? I think, I mean, one thing that is clear if you want to discuss the influence of social sciences, that's a really clear hierarchy between social sciences. I mean, you have economics on top, and then you go kind of gradually down political science, sociology, social work, or whatever, I mean, how we want to expand it. But I think what is interesting is that, say, the high value of economics vis-à-vis the other social sciences is not only about them being more sciencey, I mean, that they have models and look more like real science, but I think it's actually also that they have this extreme strong history of being politically relevant. That history have created an identity and a lot of self-confidence among economists that actually, I think, really influence also the position vis-à-vis other social sciences today. So if we want to understand it, I mean, it's kind of given, taken for granted that economics are relevant for almost everything, but the other disciplines really have to prove their relevance in a different way. So I think there's a historical element that is really important as well. I mean, of course, finding the same tendencies with different types of institutions and so on. But across the board, I think this is really important.
Add to that I agree with that. And so if you look at my own institution, for example, a policy school at Georgetown University, which has about 20 faculty members, of whom about seven have taken leaves to serve in government policymaking mm-hmm. positions. And it's almost all economists have done that, because political scientists, you know, government people in government think, well, you know, I know how to do politics, that's what I do, but the kind of substantive expertise in particular policy sectors like labor markets, for example, or welfare reform is something where there are sort of natural institutional niches within government agencies. So, for example, the Department of Labor has an office of chief economist, and these are filled on a rotating position by people who come in from academia, and two of my colleagues have held that position.
Yeah. Well, what about foreign policy, for example?
I remember, the exception is foreign policy.
I was
in the U.S.
during the Iraq War, and there seems to be a need of area experts in government
right.
and
yeah.
people
so
who
that's
are trained.
Right. International relations is the exception.
Okay, so let's turn to you, Klaus, and Scandinavia. In that part of Europe, there seems to be a rather deep confidence in experts. Many of them come from the academia and social sciences. On the other hand, there are very few public intellectuals with a high profile, and social critique is not very widespread. Even in the case of historical controversies, such as the role of eugenics in Sweden, for example, academics intervene much more as experts and in the routinized framework of public commissions, for example. Those public commissions, they have played a great role throughout the history of those countries. How do you account for such a situation and for the contrast with a country like France? Or do you see that there is an erosion of that role of social scientists, and you are a historian, so maybe you can talk about your particular point of view as a historian in that respect?
Yeah. I think overall, there has historically been a very strong confidence. Does it work now? Okay, confidence in the role of experts. So basically, that's the point in our book. So I guess I have to stick to that. But I think if you take kind of the longer time perspective, looking from the point of say through the last 100 years or so, you could argue that there's been a development from what you call a knowledge-based policies towards a more kind of want-to-know politics in this respect. If you look on the surface, I mean, we find a lot of social science influence. The number of social science experts being interviewed in media is flourishing, basically because there's more media, so there's a really kind of a need for them to comment on stuff, sometimes very weird stuff. I remember once being called by a journalist asking to comment, how does the Swedish people feel about the exposure of the Swedish king been visiting porn clubs in, I think maybe it was even Paris, I don't know. But I mean, so we get these weird questions where you really wonder, am I really an expert in this in this field? But also if you look on parliaments, so the number of parliamentary members having a social science background is really huge. I mean, in Denmark, you could say political science is almost like the Grand Ecoles of France in a way. So it's like two or three departments delivering, I don't know, a majority of MPs. But I think if you look a little bit deeper, a lot of these MPs would hardly qualify as intellectuals or even as experts, I mean, if you look upon it. And I think if you take this historical perspective, so the Nordic model has been extremely kind of this knowledge-based policy making. And if you want to understand, say, the high reform capacity of the Nordic welfare states in the golden age of golden era of the welfare states from 1930s on to the 60s or 70s. I mean, this has very much been kind of, you have to look on the role of experts. The Swedish historian Karl-Axel Gemsell have talked about how there was a scientification of politics and a politicization of science in the same period, where you can say that this is made it possible to develop political consensus about issues about distribution that in other countries were highly controversial, because you could move discussion and say this is a scientific rational solution. So, I mean, here ideology is like not having, playing a real role. Ron Eiermann, a Swedish sociologist, talked about rationalizing intellectuals as this generation of, say, policymakers, both in administration and actual politics. And what happened was basically that the lines between academia and administration and science was really blurred, so people moved, there was a lot of networks and so on. So it's really unclear to see kind of any sharp distinctions in a kind of a Weberian sense. And it's also, you're also very clear, you find this extremely strong knowledge belief in scientific knowledge. I mean, Gunnar and Alvar Myrdal, this Swedish power couple, is probably the most influential proponents of this, talking about how social engineering can create a harmonious society without any social problems, without any social conflicts. So we get like keywords like planning, rationality, social engineering, not so much about democracy, because I mean this might not all be very good for democracy, because of course the political process becomes blurred and very unclear. And I think, I mean, as it was emphasized in a book published by the Nordic Minister of Social Affairs in 1955 called Freedom and Welfare, where they said, well, politics in the Nordic countries might lack the drama of the European scene, but we have yielded a lot of practical results. It's kind of the proud. So this has become, I mean, in reality, but also, of course, part of the Nordic identity that is important. But this has been changed, this kind of happy marriage between politics and experts, I think is changing and has been changing over the last decades. So the first blow was, of course, 1968, and so this counter movement, where you had like criticism saying this establishment, the ends and the means does not lead to the ends, you cannot realize the goals, this type of imminent criticism became important, and partly also was is the explanation why sociologists did not play such an important role in Denmark, because it actually led to the closure of the sociology department in Copenhagen for some years. And then you also have, I mean, that each established expert, where you could say in the old system, there was like a very uniform system where experts and political interests were very much aligned. Now we have for each kind of official expert, you have a counter expert. Mm-hmm. So suddenly, I mean, it opens up, and you could say it's a democratization, but of course it also changes the belief and the power of being the scientific experts. And you can see this becomes important for what we call the second blow of the 1980s and 90s, where, I mean, a number of forces kind of joined and challenged this model. You have neoliberalism, you have designer politics, you have populism, I mean, broadly floating together and questioning this kind of the status of experts in politics, but also this sense, and I think this was something that ran across also some of the comments in the previous panel, that the politicians now demand much faster solutions. I mean, so the time perspective in making politics has become much shorter. And I mean, then suddenly experts become something you have to, oh my God, they're dragging me back, and I cannot kind of make this, the prompt and certain solutions I need in order to be kind of a populist or whatever you want to be. So there's been this change from knowledge base to more kind of needs to know or wants to know politics, where I think the role of experts is that experts enter a market, somehow a marketplace, where you offer expertise, but we offer it in a marketplace where politicians pick and choose. So it's a totally different different rules of the game. So, I mean, academics have to compete for influence. I mean, there's a lot of pressure from universities of being relevant because they kind of influence their funding, so they have a keen interest. But you do it on the market terms, not only competing with your other colleagues as being experts, but you also do it with kind of commercial experts. You have consultant firms. We also now have the American think tanks that kind of entered the Nordic scene from the 1980s especially. You have the politicians using this very carefully and selectively. I mean, probably the best example is the role of Bjørn Lomborg, the skeptical environmentalist in Denmark, which was kind of funded by a specific government decision on the budget to fund his project, and they actually put it into one of the universities, and they had kind of the same experience that it did not really was not very good for their brand, so they had to skip him off occasionally. But I mean, this type of selecting the experts you need, and you could also say there's been some countings on the role of the commission. I mean, this strong Nordic tradition you point at, especially in Norway and Sweden, maybe a little bit less in Denmark, that the number of commissions is now dropping, and it seems also like the commissions play a different role. So in the old days, commissions was for preparing policy reform. So it was like before you had the legislation. Now there's a lot of commission work for historians. It's become a huge market for historians, where you have to study something that happened like in the very old days. And I mean, of course, it can create huge debate and I mean public entertainment, but it's not really challenging kind of politicians from today. They'll just say, okay, well, we have to excuse this, but it happened in the 1930s and 40s. I mean, think about the Swedish debate about eugenics. So I think really, I mean, experts have to be clear that the rules of the game has been changing. It's a market out there.
And talking about expertise, counter-expertise, and social critique, there's an original Scandinavian institution that has developed in the form of audits of power and democracy since the 1970s. It started in Norway with a mandate of the government, actually, to study the functioning of the government and if it was properly functioning. And sociologists played a great role in this first audit, and then it was replicated in Sweden, as often in Scandinavia, 10 years later. And there were different other waves in Norway and then Denmark. Although in Denmark, there was no mandate from the government, if I recall well, and it was a it was more an initiative from the university, and apparently the impact was much less in Denmark. This kind of audit, they seem to also have expanded to other countries. There was a British audit that was also partly funded by I think the Joseph Rowntree Charitable Trust in the 1990s, and I think David Bitham and others were behind that audit. I think they also try to promote that in other Commonwealth countries. I thought there was one in Australia, but maybe I'm mistaken. So maybe the others can also.
Yeah, I mean, we had these in the Nordic countries. Actually, the Danish one was also, I mean, at least sponsored by the government, but using this arm's length principle. So you give them to a research council that then have to distribute the money to researchers. So I mean, slightly different, but I mean, basically the same. I mean, there's a number. I mean, they ask the same question. So it's about concentration of power. Has power become more concentrated? And was there certain groups that were excluded from, say, the political process and political influence? Coming out with different results, so the Swedish and Norwegian ones being generally more critical and creating much more public debate, where the Danish one was much less critical. Everything going well in Denmark, as you know, we're the most happy people in the world. And actually creating, I mean, almost no debate at all. I mean, the only debate came recently with a number of sociologists through network analysis, like just a few months ago, showed that the major conclusion of this, the Danish audit was actually wrong. I mean, this is probably still to be debated. But I think the explanation, and this is quite interesting, but of the differences between the countries might relate, for instance, to the disciplines being active. So in Denmark, it was dominated, I think, mainly by political scientists, where the sociologists were not playing a really important role. I mean, for historical reasons, because the Department of Sociology was closed in the 1980s for a decade, so that's kind of, they had to build up again. Whereas if you look on the Norwegian and the Swedish one, I think there was much more kind of role of sociologists was much stronger. But I think the biggest difference was actually the public debate created afterwards. But that probably also depending on the timing. So, I mean, the first Norwegian one came really well in the 1970s, where these questions about inequality and exclusion and so on was much more on the general political agenda. But the Danish one landed when, I mean, this people have lost interest in these issues, and it was all about the competition state and what have you.
Hear about the audits in Britain?
The what?
The audits, democratic audit.
No, I didn't.
No.
But if I could just maybe tap into the broader issue here, I think, is that funding always comes with an agenda and material interests. And to separate that out, I think, is not a useful thing to do because it buys into this myth of the disinterested researcher. As well, that somehow there is this ivory tower notion of knowledge production providing the providing these pure nuggets of information, analysis, and advice, and it's not the case. And I think it's not just national research councils; they do have this idea of determining broad agendas of the kind of research that they would like to see done. So national research councils do it. They might want some research done on migration or some form of economic development. The European Commission does it. And it has behind it this notion of the European project. So if we think about the current Horizon 2020 calls for Europe as a global actor, there is behind that quite disparate thinking, but nevertheless an idea about normative power Europe and about its role in the world more generally. Now, that might be dealt with in a very critical way with multiple perspectives and discussions behind it, but nevertheless, there is this idea of the European model and that there needs to be research behind it in order to articulate it and to disseminate it as well.
So, can I just jump in there for a second? So I don't disagree with Diane, but I would say that there are variations in mm-hmm. the degree of interest in material interest in funding. That in some cases, clearly there is an agenda, and there are expectations that you will support my agenda. And in other cases, I think there is more of a feeling that we don't know about what the right answer here is.
And that's the arm's length relationship,
right,
and the amount of faith that you put into academic standards and respect for them and just allowing the independence and autonomy of various kinds of research communities to go on and do that. I think we agree. Mm-hmm. I was at a conference last week in Hungary at a new university called the National University of Public Service, which has as its motto, in service of the nation, which was set up by the Orbán government with a very clear idea of how administrators should be trained and should conduct themselves. And this was clearly at the cost of other universities in Hungary, particularly Corvinus University, that lost its funding in order to go to this new university with a clear sense of what constitutes Hungarian nationhood.
Okay. talking about funding, Klaus, you said that you received funding from the Carlsberg Foundation to, among other things, write a 6-volume history of the welfare state in Denmark. What is the rationale of such a foundation funding social science research, apart from the fact that apparently it seems that there are many social scientists on the board of the foundation itself?
And Klaus, I must ask, you know, do you have a vested interest in beer? Because, you know, you got money from them.
Sure. We actually had some problems because we integrated a member of the board who has been working on social policy for a long time at some of our meetings. But then we served the local beer, Albani, and he was like a little bit upset. But I think the main reason for the Carlsberg Foundation and similar foundation, I mean, it's taxes, and it's the founders believe in that's a way of keeping the company together, and you don't have to conflicts with family members splitting it up. So, I mean, that's, of course, the logic. The logic of a lot of these foundations is that they kind of they screen research application in the same way as the research council do. So you have external evaluators. I mean, it's basically a similar process. And they, of course, as research council, they want to pick the winners so they can make a good narrative afterwards and see how good we were in supporting the right ones. I think that's basically the same logic. I mean, the problem comes, of course, if you do like research that is where you're asked to do something specific for some kind of a company or whatever with some kind of commercial or political interest. I mean, then you really have to consider, I think, in a different way. I mean, we were not expected to expose beer, and I think the only times it appears was in 1891, when the first old age pension comes in Denmark, it's financed through a tax on beer. I mean, otherwise, I think this was clearly absent.
If I can just jump in here on the external funders and foundations in particular, which you would think would not have interests. And, you know, they may not have an interest in outcomes, but they still affect the nature of the agenda. So I was co-director of a project on welfare reform in the United States about 15 years ago, and it was funded by a consortium of 8 different foundations. And none of them tried to tell us what we should find in terms of our research, but they clearly did have an impact in terms of our allocation of time and resources, in terms of there was a foundation that was based in Michigan, and we were going to have some conferences, and they wanted to make sure that one of them was in Michigan. Another one was based in California, so they wanted to make sure that we had some events in California. And so, and they all were clearly much more interested in funding research and activities that were oriented around the reauthorization of a particular piece of legislation that was coming in. Again, not telling us what to do, but the short-term focus rather than the sort of long-term basic social science research focus. And that, I think, is, you know, a change that has occurred among foundations over the last 25 years in the United States.
Maybe we can turn to Canada for a minute, and then maybe to conclude. Daniel, perhaps you could give us some ideas about the role of social scientists in policy and public debates in Canada. Is there, for example, a major difference between Quebec and French-speaking provinces and English-speaking Canada regarding these matters? And how does Canada compares to the U.S.? Is there any big difference between the U.S. and Canadian culture in this kind of relationship?
Yeah, thanks for your question. I think something that's important to understand about Canada and the same thing about the United States and Australia, but especially about Canada, and that's something that's important if you want to in the mirror of the French situation we talk about during the first roundtable, is that, to use a term that my friend Bruno Terret, a French economist who wrote about federalism, said about Canada, it was not just a decentralized country, but a decentered country. Is that you have different centers of power, and therefore expertise is also decentered. And that's a very different experience than what you see in France, where the action is really in Paris, right? We talk about one distinctive aspect of France is the distinction, the education system, the grandes écoles versus universities, which is quite unique. And then we can talk about the domination of public money, where private foundations play a lesser role than, say, in the United States in funding research, or even in Denmark. We talk about the Carlsberg Foundation. But another central aspect of France is really still, despite efforts to decentralize the institutions since the 1980s, the action is in Paris in terms of the intellectual life, the political life, the cultural life. And I remember I have this experience of a French colleague who got a position in the south of France, and he will fly once a week. He was still living in Paris, will fly once a week, spend a full day teaching his courses, and then will go back to Paris. Okay, fly the same evening. So because he told me, if you want to have influence, and he was interested in having some political influence, you need to be in Paris. Okay, in Canada, you know, you don't need to be in Ottawa to have some influence. Ottawa is not the cultural capital of the country, far from that. Toronto and Montreal compete for that title, Toronto for English-speaking Canada and Montreal for French-speaking Canada. It's not the economic capital either, while Paris is all of that all at once. The same thing in the U.S. Of course, it's a much bigger country, and being inside the beltway is important if you want to have political influence at the federal level, but the state level is highly developed as well, and you can make a good career studying what's happening at the state level. And in Canada, you have some academics who don't care about what's happening at the federal level. They want to provide policy advice at the provincial level. For example, if you work on healthcare in Canada, unless you're interested in Aboriginal issues, nothing is going on at the federal level. It's all done in the provinces, and that's the largest source of public expenses in Canada in terms of budgeting, it's healthcare, right? Even in pensions, most of the system is federal, but in Quebec, they have their own earnings-related pension plan, the Quebec pension plan. And so if you studied pensions in Quebec, you might be interested only at the provincial level. That creates some problems, of course, because in Canada, we talk about two solitudes, right? People who live in the same country don't interact that much. And certainly, you can understand that if you're in the province of Quebec, a lot of people, they only care about what's happening in Quebec, and they actually want to separate from the rest of Canada. So for them, the idea that they will go to Ottawa to provide advice to the Privy Council, for example, and high-ranked civil servant would be just anathema. But you have federalists, public intellectuals and experts who are more than willing to go to Ottawa. We actually a major, a well-known political scientist that Ken knows, Stéphane Dion, who became a federal minister and then the leader of the Liberal Party. He ran for office and he became an MP, but was defeated when he tried to become a prime minister. Oops, my microphone, okay, still there. And so you have examples of people who can play a role at the provincial and the federal level. But I think a major thing that you have to understand about Canada is that it's really a federal system, and in a way it's a federal society. And when you go to English-speaking Canada, I think they are looking more towards Ottawa, but again, you can be very active at the provincial level because a lot of the major policy issues, they take place in the provinces, and Ottawa is not that much involved at all if it's a competency that's purely provincial or might be only one of the partners involved. So I think this is important to understand that aspect. Now, if you want to know the differences between Quebec and the rest of Canada, again, everything in Quebec is historically tainted by the national question, whether you're a federalist or you're a sovereigntist. Things are changing today to a certain extent because there are issues like the environment, for example, that have little to do with the national question, but that's still always in the back of people's mind. What is, I think, important all across Canada, and you see that in the United States as well, and we talk about that during the French table, is that economists, I think, have the most authority in terms of legitimacy to speak about public policy in most circles. But there is this problem that was also mentioned, I think that you mentioned earlier, that economists who are trained in economics department are most of them are very poorly prepared to provide policy advice because their language is mathematics. And this is not the language of policymakers, of most policymakers. And even at our school in Canada, we witnessed, like in the United States, a multiplication of policy schools. It's the American model. And we have witnessed over the last 20 years really. We have more than double the number of policy schools. Of course, it's a small country, so we don't have that many. But it's a growing part of academia. But when we get economists at our school, junior economists, they need to adapt and learn how to actually provide policy advice and deal with concrete policy issues. Because if you're trained in a regular economics department, you learn about really theory and methods at a very advanced level, but concrete policy issues are not really valued within the discipline. And that's the case as well, I think, in France. So I would say that economics remains dominant, but you have people from other disciplines who play a role in policy making and policy advice. And you have also people who have this disdain for policy advice. I see that within my discipline of origin, sociology, people who think that you should not give interviews to the media, you should not comment on public issues, that you're wasting your time, you should just publish journal articles. But there's also this view that you know, working with government is something that is corrupting you as a scholar. And you still have this view, but I think the emergence of these policy schools, as Kent mentioned, is changing a bit the perspective. And there is the idea, yes, as Diane mentioned, that we want to be relevant, and a way for social scientists to be relevant is to speak about policy issues and public issues. It's not just about public policy in the narrow sense of the term, it's also about public affairs, about dealing with a broad debates that people, ordinary people, are interested in. And so that's about relevance. But it's a contested issue, relevance. And some people think that we are going too far in that direction and we are corrupting the spirit of academia. So it's an ongoing debate in Canada as elsewhere.
Just to pick up on some things that Daniel said at the end, a couple of trends that have occurred in the think tank world that I think show the increasing capacity to try to be relevant to the audience. When I went to the Brookings Institution in 1983, the communication staff was one person. I think the communication staff is now 20 people, and they're embedded within all the research programs. And so there are people there who are trying to help get scholars to make their research more policy relevant. And if you look at the Brookings website, they now produce some pretty sophisticated web videos that are you know, quite well done. And another thing that's happened is the staff of Brookings is about 150 scholars, and they now have about 250 affiliated scholars based in universities, and that expertise is also, communications expertise is available to those affiliated mm-hmm. scholars. So there's more institutional capacity now to provide the translation.
And I must say that universities are now imitating think tanks, and we see that in the US and Canada, we have more communication people. And at our university, at our school, we have an outreach and training office, and we have people who are reaching out to civil servants, but also to the public, and media relations is important. We don't have the capacity of Brookings, of course, but I think within academia, you see that this effort to look relevant, at least, regardless you are or not, and the attempt also to have policy briefs and publish short documents and letters to newspapers or op-eds, which are available to a broader audience. That's part of, there is this discussion that universities should play a greater role in being visible outside the ivory tower. And that's a very important trend. There is some resistance against it. There are some people who think, you know, giving a media interview is corrupting, but I think it's not the dominant trend. The dominant trend is, say, you have to be out there, and if you give interviews, and if your work is available to people outside academia, it's a good thing. And I think we are following the trend, I think, that started with think tanks, because the relevance of think tanks is largely about their visibility, right? And increasingly, this logic is, I think, becoming part of academia, and it's especially true in policy schools.
Thank you. Just on this notion of relevance, we tend to talk about relevance in the short term, about impact. It's about getting the media interview or recognition for a publication or appointment to a commitment. And we sometimes forget that one of the best forms of relevance is the long-term effect of the students we produce and the human capital that is built up over a generation or more. and the evidence base of research of multiple scholars that generates an understanding that is not contested of cause and effect relationships in fields of medicine, but also in the social sciences as well. But just going back to students and the production of students, one thing I do not worry about, but it is an issue I think that has not been of concern to my generation, and that is the overproduction of PhD students, certainly in Australia, in the UK, I guess in the United States as well. And where do they go? They do go into government, they do go into NGOs, they do go into various kinds of other organisations, and these are going to be consumers of social science research. They don't just stop being social scientists if they don't get a job in academia.
They also do become unemployed in several countries, like this one.
But just to bounce back on that, I think it's a very important point. And the growing number of policy schools, not just in the United States and Canada and Australia, is also an attempt to disseminate policy knowledge and to create a larger and larger group of scholars who know about policy and are interested in policy. And these people will not all work for government, and that's important. It will work for international organizations. They could work even in the private sector as policy analysts. They can work for NGOs. So and they can even launch their own, they can become consultants. And so that's important to understand that it's, I think, the advent of the multiplication of policy schools is important, and I think it's helpful in terms of creating bridges, building bridges between academia and the world of policy and public affairs, even more generally.
Good. Let me just piggyback on that. I agree completely. And about a third of the master's graduates of our policy school go to work for government. About a third go mm-hmm. to the private sector. About a third go to the NGO and international organization sector. So it does help break down those barriers between sectors, which I think is somewhat different from the French situation.
Maybe.
Very different.
Yeah. although it would be interesting to see how the French, what is the position of French social science at the international level, for example. And okay, we have 10 minutes left, and maybe it's time to open the floor for possible questions before the audience disappears altogether. So if there are questions...
Oui, peut-être que je parlerai français, parce que ce sera peut-être plus facile pour poser la question. Je pourrais la poser en anglais, mais je ne suis pas sûr que... oui, donc moi je voulais intervenir par rapport à une question qu'on n'a pas abordée ici, qui était très présente dans les deux jours précédents du colloque, qui est, j'ai fait mon master ici à l'EHESS, et j'ai eu beaucoup de mal ensuite à poursuivre en doctorat, notamment parce que j'ai un parcours précédent qui vient des sciences naturelles, et j'ai un type de questionnement qui est différent. Bon, j'ai résolu ce questionnement depuis, mais... par rapport aux sciences sociales, les fondements épistémologiques de la discipline sont plus faibles que pour les autres sciences dures plus classiques. Et j'aimerais savoir, vous qui êtes à l'interface entre la recherche et la demande publique, l'action concrète, comment vous faites pour argumenter, amener la preuve dans votre travail au quotidien pratique pour arriver à avoir ce souci d'objectivité et de persuasion que pourrait amener une preuve qui, malheureusement, a peut-être plus de difficultés par rapport à l'ancrage des sciences sociales sur le domaine de la science et des sciences dures et de la façon comment on les conçoit d'habitude. Comment vous faites pour, en pratique, amener votre argument dans la discussion politique pour faire changer les choses ?
So I have a question for the international panel. Yesterday in the conference, we talked a lot about the critique function of social science, which clearly in the French tradition is very important, and at EHESS it is, and it's still viewed as something, the French intellectual position and the way that scholars should intervene in the public debate. So we didn't talk about that neither in the first roundtable and this one. But it seems to me that this runs into conflict with the expertise function, and maybe the problems we identified for the interactions in France with higher administration and social science scholars may also be linked with the importance of the critique function for social science. I was wondering what you were thinking about that.
Et je peux peut-être répondre, peut-être de mon point de vue pendant que j'ai le micro. Juste, alors, ce qui a été un petit peu dit, c'est que pour un économiste, c'est plus facile, au sens où c'est plus facile parce qu'on arrive avec des données quantifiées, une approche et peut-être aussi une confiance en soi, en tout cas sur les termes des preuves qu'on apporte aux décideurs publics. C'est probablement plus difficile lorsqu'on est sur des champs ou des disciplines où la notion de preuve empirique est beaucoup plus difficile à apporter, et donc c'est probablement explique en grande partie des fois les difficultés d'autres disciplines des sciences sociales et d'une certaine façon la relative facilité des économistes à essayer d'influencer dans le débat public.
Ouais, écoutez, you want to start about this, the first question?
That was a tough question. No, that's all right, I've got something here. This issue of proof, yeah, objective truth, it's really, really difficult. And this is where I think I start to make the distinction between three different kinds of knowledge. In the sense of epistemic knowledge, which is about providing scientific knowledge and certainty in demonstrating cause and effect relationships as one kind of knowledge. Secondly, techne, and I am drawing on Aristotle here, in the sense that this is much more of an experimental knowledge and that you develop through craft, experience, and developing the skill set. And then thirdly, phronesis, in the sense of judgment and wisdom and providing a normative understanding of what is good knowledge or good knowledge in the sense of ethical knowledge, I think. Okay, and it's the balance between those three, and they're always in contest, and I have no easy answer other than to recognise those different balances and weightings that go with those different kinds of knowledges and ensuring that in some way all three come through in some fashion. I really like this idea of counterposing the critic and the public intellectual with the expertise function. I think certainly in my two countries, we're being increasingly channeled through funding incentives into the expertise role, and there isn't as much credence being given to the public intellectual role. And there are national peculiarities there as well, because in Australia you have very highly concentrated ownership of the media. So as a consequence, critical voices find it tougher, you know, to get a representative voice through newspapers and television and those sort of outlets. But it creates innovation, in a sense. You find other outlets, other ways of doing it, and predominantly that's been through social media.
Pour votre première question, je vais répondre en français, comme vous l'avez posé en français. C'est vrai que les sciences naturelles, en termes de légitimité, ont un avantage. Et c'est vrai aussi que les économistes ont un avantage et qu'en général, en tout cas en Amérique du Nord, les chiffres parlent. Et si on n'arrive pas avec des données quantitatives, c'est considéré comme étant un peu subjectif, un peu bon. Alors, il faut quand même s'armer avec des chiffres et avec des données. Et bon, on a le fardeau de la preuve et c'est parfois assez lourd. Mais si les sciences naturelles ont un avantage, il y a aussi un désavantage, c'est que souvent, les gens qui viennent de ce milieu des sciences naturelles ne comprennent pas vraiment les questions politiques. Et on a, à notre école, par exemple, je connais une étudiante qui, elle, a fait toute sa carrière vraiment en biologie. Et quand elle commence même si c'est des politiques en agriculture, par exemple, qui concernent l'agriculture, elle connaît bien l'aspect scientifique, mais dès qu'on commence à parler de questions plus politiques, parce que c'est impossible d'y échapper quand on parle de politique publique, hein? Eh bien là, elle commence à paniquer. En fait, elle me dit, moi, j'arrive pas vraiment à vraiment comprendre ces questions-là de ce point de vue. Alors, les gens qui proviennent des sciences naturelles et qui doivent, par exemple, essayer de donner leur opinion, parce que ça reste une opinion concernant les politiques environnementales ou l'agriculture, ou bon, ces gens-là doivent aussi apprendre. Nous, on doit apprendre, d'une certaine façon, à projeter cette image de rigueur qu'on a déjà, mais si on fait, par exemple, des travaux qualitatifs, il faut parfois aussi essayer d'emprunter des autres disciplines aussi, de montrer que c'est pas seulement bon qu'on a on a par exemple avoir les économistes de son côté, ça peut être bon au Canada par exemple, même si on est par exemple dans mon cas sociologue. Mais pour les gens des sciences naturelles, il y a aussi, je pense, un défi qui est particulier, qui est celui d'apprendre cet aspect plus subjectif, mais aussi plus conflictuel. C'est pas quand on parle de politique publique, c'est pas seulement une vérité au sens très étroit du terme, mais les gens en sciences naturelles souvent ont de la difficulté à penser en ces termes-là.
Sur ce point, on n'a pas beaucoup parlé des philosophes et des historiens. C'est vrai qu'en France, les intellectuels publics, les philosophes ont joué un rôle important. Les historiens, dans une certaine mesure, avec tous les procès, tous les débats autour des procès historiques de Vichy, de ce genre de choses, est-ce que c'est quelque chose qui est différent de ce point de vue? On a l'impression qu'aux États-Unis, par exemple, ce rôle public des historiens est nettement moins important. Qu'est-ce qu'il en est, Klaus, aussi, pour le Danemark, étant historien?
I think I need this one. So that's a difficult question. But I think, if you look on it historically, these kind of public figures have been more prominent, for instance, in Norway and Sweden than compared to Denmark. Does this work better? Yeah. Okay. But I think overall the role of historians have been fairly limited, except for certain topics like the heated debates about the Cold War and what was going on. I mean, that can kind of... But I think that belongs to the world of, say, public amusement, more about policy, more than policy making. If I can get back to this question about the different types of criticism, I actually, some years ago, together with a Swedish colleague, we tried to develop a typology of criticism in the Nordic welfare state, which I think is also telling for the historical development. So we came up with three worlds of welfare state criticism. We had to do that. Where we said the first type of criticism, and that's the period where critics and experts are basically the same group, where the experts and the critics kind of call for more reform, saying we are in the right direction, we have the right goals, but we need kind of the last reforms to get the last group taken out of poverty, to get the last groups included in society, and so on. I mean, this is a very strong discourse among social policy experts in the, say, 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s. So we have institutions like the National Institute for Social Research in Denmark, established in the 50s, kind of having a light cast casting out on Danish landscape, and then finding small groups that have not been included yet, and then proposing how to deal with that. But that changes again in the 1960s, where you get with this type of immanent criticism that by nature is very different. So where they argue that the goals might be the right ones, to create more equality, to have a more harmonious society and so on, but the needs will never realize the goals. That was basically Marx's criticism of capitalism to some degree as well. And then what really makes a big change is what's going on in the 80s and 90s, where you get what we have called exterritorial criticism. So it's criticism that is simply not accepting the classical goal of the welfare state. So, I mean, the goal of inequality, no way. I mean, we need to be competitive. And, I mean, all these classical goals of social policy being kind of abandoned or turned upside down. And these two latter types of criticism, they kind of, I think, bring some conflict between, say, the establishment, administrators, and the public experts. So, I mean, it's not only a historical development, because you have all three layers all the time, but I think you can say the importance of the different layers changes over time.
If I can go back to the second question, where you posed the distinction between expertise and critique,
I'm not sure that I would frame it that way, because that suggests that people who pose fundamental critiques may not be experts, which I don't think is what you meant to say. I would, you know, I would frame it more as policy relevant versus critiques that if you are engaged in a, you know, a really strong critique of the policy status quo, you're probably going to alienate a lot of policymakers who hold power, and therefore they're not going to listen to you and see you as being hostile to them, which you probably are. And a second thing is that they're relative for critiques to be policy relevant. They're relatively narrow policy windows where a real fundamental critique of the status quo is likely, there's likely to be an opening in terms of political change, parties in power, or whatever, to go beyond incremental reform. So I think that if you fundamentally want to engage in critique, I think that most of the time you're going to face the policy or the trade-off that you're less likely to be policy relevant, and not to say that one is more valuable to the other than the other.
You're just relevant to somebody else.
I mean, one thing that's just, I know we are running out of town, out of time, but it's important too that there is a trend. We talk about community-based research, for example, where people, and you have scholars who are interested in policy issues and social change, and who really work with, let's say, Aboriginal communities in Canada or Australia, or work with ethnic minorities, and they embed themselves in the community, and they partner with the community, and that's a way for them to be relevant. And that's another form of, this is a form of social critique, but that's about bringing change alongside social actors from the civil society. But that poses another set of problems about whether you're still an academic where you're totally embedded in the community, or you're basically promoting the vision or the interest of a particular group in society. So that poses another set of issues. As for the status of the intellectual who's really detached and critique and this vision that goes back to the Enlightenment in a way, I think it's not dead. It's still a vision that exists in other countries. It's not just in France, but it's true that it's been, it's not the dominant, it's not the dominant approach to how academics can make a difference. And again, in our universities, if people write essays and they take public stances on different issues, and they don't define themselves as experts who provide advice, but people who fight against inequality in general or for gender emancipation and so forth, these people have to show that they matter in a way or another. So relevance is not, as you said, something that narrow, and we have to always keep that in mind, right? We want to make a difference in a way or another, but if we define that difference in a very narrow and technical way, I think we are shooting ourselves in the foot as academics. J'ai la parole, c'est dangereux de me dire ça, hein? Attention, j'ai la parole. On va conclure en français parce qu'on est quand même à Paris. Et je veux remercier tous les participants de la première table ronde. Dominique Schnapper qui a dû nous quitter un peu plus tôt pour des raisons personnelles. Évidemment, les intervenants de la deuxième table ronde. Thank you very much for your participation. Oui, on peut applaudir. Merci à tous. Bon, on peut pas tirer de... Il y a beaucoup de leçons à tirer de la discussion, évidemment. On a appris plein de choses. On a appris des choses au sujet de ce qui est spécifique à la France. On a parlé, évidemment, de la distinction entre les grandes écoles et les universités. Donc, le système d'éducation en France qui est vraiment très, très... reste distinct. Et on sait que ça affecte tout, en fait, pour ce qui est du rôle des sciences sociales dans le domaine des politiques publiques. On a parlé de la centralisation, l'aspect philanthropique qui est moins développé en France que dans beaucoup d'autres pays. On a parlé aussi de la variété des différentes formes d'expertise et aussi de la tension entre expertise et critique. Et ça reste, je pense, un enjeu qui disparaîtra pas demain matin. Ça va rester... je pense que c'est essentiel lorsqu'on parle de de donner un rôle aux sciences sociales au-delà du monde académique au sens étroit du terme, ben, il va falloir on débat de notre propre identité en tant que chercheur, en tant que professeur, en tant qu'enseignant, notre identité et notre relation avec d'autres groupes, d'autres acteurs dans la société. Et je pense que ce questionnement-là, il est sain et qu'on doit toujours se poser la question, ben, pourquoi on fait ce qu'on fait? C'est quoi notre légitimité? Il faut aussi, on se regarde dans le miroir à la fin d'une journée de travail, on se dit, mais qu'est-ce qu'on a accompli? Qu'est-ce qu'on fait? À quoi ça sert? Bon, je ne veux pas devenir là, faire un spleen existentialiste, mais c'est quand même le questionnement, il faut le faire, mais il faut aussi agir et il faut essayer de changer les choses d'une manière ou d'une autre. Et je pense que c'est une bonne chose pour les universitaires d'essayer de faire une différence et d'essayer d'affecter bon, le monde extérieur, si on veut, déjà via l'enseignement. Diane Stone a raison de mentionner notre rôle en tant qu'enseignant, c'est absolument déterminant. Et il y a un problème dans le monde universitaire qu'on voit beaucoup aujourd'hui, c'est l'obsession justement pour l'argent, le financement de la recherche, les publications et l'enseignement. On le voit parfois dans mon milieu en Amérique du Nord, où l'enseignement est considéré comme étant vraiment secondaire au rôle même des universités, ce qui est quand même paradoxal. Toutes sortes de questions sur la nature même de l'université, la nature des sciences sociales, leur rôle et leur signification pour la société en général. Il y a des différences nationales, il y a une mondialisation de l'expertise d'une certaine façon, mais il y a aussi une fragmentation de l'expertise. Et je pense qu'il faut vraiment définir les termes et définir quel type d'expertise on parle et aussi quel type de critique sociale on parle. Parce que est-ce qu'on critique au nom de l'intérêt général, ce qui reste à définir et qui est problématique, où on critique au nom d'un certain groupe dans la société pour plus d'égalité ou d'inclusion. Alors, il y a toutes sortes de questions qui restent à poser. Et aujourd'hui, on a commencé un débat, mais un débat qui va continuer, j'espère, pour des années et des années à venir. Et j'espère qu'on a fait une contribution en posant quelques questions. Merci à vous pour vos questions et votre présence. Et bonne fin de journée.